and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast from the Hoover Institution. I'm your host, Troy Sinek, and I am joined, as always, by the Libertarian himself, Professor Richard Epstein, the Peter and Kirsten Bedford Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, the Lawrence A. Tisch Professor of Law at NYU, and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, Common Good Capitalism. And Richard, there's been a lot of ferment in conservative circles over the past few years about whether conservatism has been too blindly loyal to laissez-faire economics. The term some people will use for that as kind of an epithet is market fundamentalism. And some of this, of course, is inspired by Donald Trump, but there have been a number of people on the right, independent of him, who've been thinking about these issues in ways that just a few years ago would have probably been anathema in Republican circles. And it's come to pass that one of the most visible figures on that front is now Marco Rubio, who recently wrote a piece in National Review based on a speech that he had given at Catholic University in Washington called The Case for Common Good Capitalism. Now, there are a bunch of substantive points for us to get to in there, but I want to start with a broader one, Richard. That phrase, the common good, you hear it all the time in political discourse. It comes up in political philosophy discussions. What goes through the head of a classical liberal like yourself when you hear the phrase the common good being appealed to?
Well, I wrote a book which had the phrase common good into its title. And, you know, the central clause, principles for a free society, reconciling individual liberty with the common good. I think it's a very, very powerful thing. But I view this in a completely different way from the way in which Marco Rubio does it. What he seems to think of is that you look at common good capitalism, and what you therefore say is there are going to be some very strong restraints on the way in which market transactions will determine wages, prices for goods, and so forth, to take into account what he calls the dignity of the family and the need to establish various kinds of strong communities. I think of it in a very different way. It turns out that market institutions have to be on top of a system of public facilities which cannot be funded voluntarily. You need courts, you need roads, you need various kinds of infrastructures. And so the question that you have to ask, in my view, is how do you put these things into place through common activities of the government when you know that markets cannot supply that? This is not an argument to say that where markets work, you have to soften them down to take into account these dignitary situations. It's simply an argument that if you try to create public facilities like roads and do so on a voluntary basis, they will never get funded, ran, and organized. So you therefore have to develop a huge body of law which starts to deal with the regulation of common carriers and public utilities. You also have to develop something like the antitrust laws to deal with incipient threats of monopoly. But otherwise, what you do is you do out pure competitive forces work where those things could work. So then the second question is, what do these pure competitive forces look like? And what's so absolutely extraordinary about the way in which the non-capitalists describe them is that all these relationships turn out to be extraordinarily thin. You are an employer, you pay somebody a wage, that person does you work, and there are no effective ties whatsoever that exist between the two parties to the relationship. It's simply a cash and carry kind of business. There is no business, repeat, no business which has ever been able to thrive if it has that kind of a stick characterization of what a capitalist market looks like. Markets always have to have two kinds of rules. They have to have soft rules enforced by custom and common practice about the way in which you treat and work with other people. And then they have to have more hard-edged, simple rules which are going to determine the way in which you start to deal with legal enforcement. And if you don't have that two-tier system, you'll break down at either or both levels. So, for example, if you want to do in a workplace and you've got lots of individuals together, you always have various kinds of common issues that you have to resolve. What kind of music do you put in the background? When do workers take their common breaks? Where is the equipment going to be located? What kinds of communications are going to be done? And so every business which is capitalist has a wage relationship, but they also have worker committees, they have suggestion boxes, they have annual meetings in which you start to talk about goals and plans, and you chat that not only at the top levels, but you have to bring in lower workers in order to make them feel some degree of esprit. But you have all of this stuff, but do you enforce it as a matter of law? The answer is no. In the legal side, what you do is you want contracts at will. And what that says is you could fire any employee, or that employee can quit for good reason, no reason, or bad reasons. That is, you can do it whichever way that you want. And the theory is, if you have that kind of legal relationships, you don't get caught into the impossible business of trying to figure out, if something goes wrong on the job, whether it was an employee who was disrespecting his employer or an employer who was disrespecting an employee, what you do is you protect employees by having a market where if you were dissatisfied with one job, it's a fairly active market and you could be hired in another one. And so in the Trump situation now, where he has been, for the most part, very unwilling to enforce a lot of the labor laws and so forth, you see wages rising and employers bidding for people. And what they always do is they offer them something which they think they will really want, that they're willing to pay for: part-time, educational instruction, healthcare benefits, or whatever it is. You look at Marco Rubio, none of these things could ever happen because he's insisting that these relationships are just simply a cash and carry business without any of these tones. But in fact, all of these things start to work. And if you get a much more accurate sense of the way in which markets work, what you realize, if you try to legislate the kinds of things that create dignity and community and so forth, what you do is you destroy their ability to obtain their particular ends. And so you're going to be worse off than if you had done nothing at all.
All right. So let's deal with some of the particulars here from Rubio. One of his criticisms of the economic status quo is what he calls our financialized economy. And he sort of implies that that comes at the expense of ordinary workers. So this is from the National Review piece. I'm quoting him. Large corporations have become vehicles for shareholders and banks to assert claims to cash flows rather than engines of productive innovation. Over the past 40 years, the financial sector's share of corporate profits increased from about 10 to nearly 30%. The share of profits sent to shareholders increased by 300%. This occurred while investment of those profits back into the company's workers and future dropped 20%. Last year, corporations on the S&P 500 spent more than $1 trillion buying back their own shares. These are the largest corporations in the world collectively saying, we don't have anything to invest in. How do you respond to that?
I regard this as a complete statement of ignorance. It's almost impossible to say how utterly muddle-headed I think he is. On the first point, why do we invest more money in financial institutions? Because it turns out that they pay off a lot more than they did. I was teaching just this issue today, and we were talking about various kinds of frauds that took place in credit card markets and so forth, circa 1964, where you didn't have an internet system that you could deal with this. And these things took place at a very high rate. What happens is, when you get professionals who know how to run these systems, what you can do is you can increase the volume of transactions enormously and simultaneously reduce the fraud risk that is going to happen. The reason we have more investment in this area is because we've been able to get a very high rate of return to the various people who are working in this system. They also generate jobs for people to work in, and in fact, what they do is they generate services that people want. You look at the manufacturing segment, you know, a lot of this stuff was very dignified back-breaking work. But if you actually look at the total volume of business in the manufacturing sector, it continues to move smartly up, but the number of workers that you need in order to do this is down. And so what are you doing? You're taking people who used to pour molten steel from one container into another, and you replace all of them with one guy who sits in a control room and can do this all automatically. All of a sudden, your workman's compensation premiums go down. You have many fewer physical injuries start to take place, and these people are released into other parts of the market. And so what do? They increase in many places the service sector. We have a real demand for health care in the United States today with an aging population. And so you have people who could do physical therapy instead of having to work these kinds of machines. Or you have exercise coaches, or you have restaurants, or you have life coaches. The entire shift in the marketplace is perfectly benevolent. There is simply something totally incorrect on the part of Rubio to sort of say that whatever the sectoral balance was with respect to the economy 50 years ago, somehow or other, you need to keep that. It's therefore wholly misleading to start to look at the decline of workers in one particular section and to ignore the gain that you start to get in the next. Then what he does is he starts to talk about the buybacks. On this point, the economics is absolutely clear. Buybacks in general are a good thing. Why is that? Well, you have a very large corporation that generates excess cash, and it turns out large corporations are pretty good at supplying stable goods, but the huge amount of cash that goes through these organizations make them a very poor platform for starting up new and innovative businesses. So if you have a $100 million corporation and some guy comes along and he could take $100 million and turn it to $1 billion, that's going to be just a rip on a very large firm like that. And indeed, given the fact that these guys in large firms tend to worry about controls and the like stuff, it's a very unhospitable environment for doing that. So if you put the money out into shareholders, the venture capitalists get together and they back smaller ventures. And if you could take a small venture at $100 million and turn it into $1 billion, you got a tenfold rate of return. So it's not as though the money is just going to sit there. It's going to be given to people who have better incentives to do the kinds of innovations that you want. Large firms are not very good at innovation. They're very good at supplying mass products. And so what you're seeing here is a sense that if you've got this stuff, it's the redeployment of capital into more efficient ways. So when a firm is saying this, it's not saying that we can't do anything with the money. It's saying that other people can do more with the money than we can. These are things that you really want to develop. So one of the nice things about the Trump administration is if you start looking at the number of startups under Obama, where everybody saw cloudy seas ahead and very difficult waters, they were going consistently down. Literally, the day that Obama goes out of office and Trump starts to come in, people are saying, we got a guy who's going to sort of leave us alone a little bit more. We can then redeploy these things. And all of a sudden, the number of startup ventures starts to turn around and to get larger. Why it is that you think, in effect, that you have to have large firms continue to be stable in the form that they were doing it instead of new forms springing up is completely beside the point. If you look at other companies which really talk about the dignity of the worker, in Europe, for example, they don't start anything. Whereas in the United States, if you start to look at the major companies that have come up and you start seeing Facebook and eBay and Apple and so forth, what happens is we're much more able than these other countries to start to generate large major businesses. And these large businesses then create all sorts of satellite opportunities for smaller firms to start to do with them. So there's nothing wrong with laissez-faire capitalism. What there is a lot wrong with a gooey kind of sentimentalism, which doesn't understand how these markets work. And so starts to privilege physical labor over intellectual labor, which is a mistake, or the maintenance of large corporations and the status quo over the formation of new businesses better able to do innovation, which is also a kind of mistake, and starts to treat dignity as an enforceable obligation instead of a necessary corollary of the business. Rubio is wrong on every single thing that he talks about. All the good stuff that he wants is better obtained in the manner that I've talked about. Competitive firms who are subject to both social and on the one hand and legal restraints on the other.
So part of the indictment that he's offering, and this taps into, I think, a broader social anxiety, is that we've had this shift in American economics towards more of a knowledge economy, that it's more tech-driven, provides higher returns to education, and that if you're someone who doesn't have a college degree or works in a blue-collar line of work, it doesn't have a whole lot to offer you. And he says that if you're in New York or Los Angeles or Washington, this probably doesn't make much of a difference in your life, but there are whole parts of the American interior whose industry is leaving and hope is drying up, and you can't tell these people to code, and you can't just pat them on the head and tell them that given enough time, the market's going to solve everything. What's your response to that critique?
Again, I think he's completely wrong about all of this. I mean, first of all, what you have to do is to ask yourself, why is it that the returns to manual labor and stuff go down? In part, it's because there is a greater demand for intellectual capital. That's fine and good. But in part, it turns out that low-level workers are subject to the same kind of regulation as higher-income workers. And as a percentage of their salary, these are much more onerous burdens. So if somebody wants to hire somebody for $10 an hour and they have to pay $3 in terms of public overhead, it's a 30% hit. If you hire somebody at $40 and you're paying $3, it's a 7.5% hit. Well, which are you going to do? You're going to tend to move up. So as the restrictions start to go down, we have found in the last 2 years that the greatest increase in wages have come at the lowest part of the market. Because it turns out that if, in fact, you let these people work, there's somebody who could figure out how to hire them. Tasks that had gone previously neglected will now start to be done, whether it's fixing boxes, boxes, they're changing things in the building, who knows what it is. And so there's a huge demand for this. We even see older people on retirement. What they do is they follow the traffic north. They're in the south in March, and by the time August comes, they're up there in Maine doing works in convenience stores and other kinds of things like that. So, I mean, it would be, I think, only incumbent upon somebody like Marco Rubio to actually look at some of the success stories instead of just treating this as a grim story in which the gaps start to get larger and larger and larger. If you really want to free the people at the bottom of the market, you cannot try to protect them by various kinds of legislation. You don't protect them by a minimum wage law. You don't protect them by an age discrimination law. You don't protect them by a family leave policy. What you do is you protect them by allowing somebody to give them a bid, knowing full well that if his bid is not taken, this guy's got a better alternative to go somewhere else. The single most powerful inducement for improved condition is the fear that you are going to lose a good employee to somebody else who's going to pay him more. And generally speaking, if you talk to employers, you tell them, you don't wait until somebody is going to leave unless you give them an offer. You want to give them a wage which is large enough so they're not going to be looking for trouble anyhow. They have enough confidence in you. And that's the way the bottom end of the particular market has been working. So it's just wrong to use Jeremiah's. And I keep saying in the following period, who was the man who was most solicitive of workers? Who was the guy who was trying to put in protections for unions and under the Fair Labor Standards Act and so forth? It was Barack Obama. Who was the president who had the worst record with respect to job improvement at the bottom end of the market? Barack Obama. Because what he thought were protections were, in fact, blockades against your ability to do something else, something more, in any way, shape, or form. And so, again, it turns out it's just terrible for people to, you know, to criticize laissez-faire capitalism by first putting it into a caricature and then assuming all the results that it's so terrible without actually starting to examine the way in which it goes. Let me just give you one other kind of situation. There's a man named Robert Gordon who wrote a book about the rise and fall of American growth. And it turns out, what was the period in which American growth, not only in terms of dollars, but in terms of the sort of the necessities of life and the improvement of overall condition, improved the greatest? And hands down, it's the period, roughly speaking, between about 1870 and 1940. So by the time you're done with this period, life expectancy has gone up by over 20 years. And I can guarantee you, it's a line I like to use, that 20% increase was not concentrated all in the top 1% of the population, right? It's not as though some people were living 300 years and other people hadn't moved up at all. And that's the era of laissez-faire capitalism in the United States. That's the so-called dreaded Lochner era. The progressives always had terrible stories, much like the ones that Rubio is trying to tell you. But if you actually looked at the raw numbers, life expectancy, wages, all sorts of amenities, health was one. All of these things are starting to move up. And why is that? Because a free market can outproduce any one of these other things. And in terms of the soft skills that you want, every market's going to have to provide them. Not in every case. Do you really want to go to your ATM machine and the first thing when you ask for your money is they say, are you feeling all right today? And you have to answer, I'm feeling fine. And then what the machine is going to ask you, do you think you're being oppressed by your bank? And you have to answer yes or no. Oh, they don't want that. In a cash machine, what you want to make sure is that the money comes out, no questions asked, so long as you have it in your account. On the other hand, when you go to a psychologist, you go to a guidance counselor, somebody like that, you don't want to have the same kind of relationship. And so markets essentially differentiate between these stricti iuris, that's the Roman term, sort of strict legal relationships, no questions asked, highly impersonal when you're drafting checks or taking money out of an ATM machine, and those which are much more bona fide, that is good faith relationships when you're dealing with partnerships and relationships of trust. Markets already make those distinctions, and Mr. Rubio is utterly oblivious to the fact that they've been made this way as ever since Roman times.
So the last thing I'll ask you, one is struck when listening to this debate about how some of the people who are on Rubio's side of the argument frame it. Because beyond their substantive argument, there's also a strategic one where they say, look, this invisible hand stuff doesn't sell. And they'd argue that that's because it doesn't necessarily work as advertised. But it doesn't sell. And if you don't adopt our ideas as a corrective for its excesses, then you lose and you get democratic socialism of the Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren variety. And if you think we're hostile to markets, wait until you get a load of those guys. Now, that's striking on the merits, but also because it echoes the diagnosis you hear sometimes of Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal. People will say, you know, you conservatives try to make FDR look like some sort of a radical on domestic policy, but the New Deal was an accommodation that kept us from sliding into fascism or communism. How much do you buy this argument that you sort of have to get an insurance policy, you sort of have to hedge for capitalism and accept two-thirds because the reaction to try and go whole hog will just be total blowback?
I think it's a complete mistake. Let's though start with our friend Roosevelt and what his great contribution was. Roosevelt essentially was able to rail against monopolies and to say how terrible they were. And, you know, every classical liberal believes that the antitrust laws, when applied to monopolies, may in principle make some kind of an improvement, particularly with horizontal arrangements like various kinds of market divisions on the one hand or cartel pricing on the other. And so that's not the test. But what Roosevelt did under the name of saving capitalism was he put forward a set of cartels in virtually every conceivable industry that you could find. It covered motor vehicles. It covered all sorts of labor relationships. It covered airlines. It covered agricultural products, on and on. He put together so many of these things. Every one of these things was a disaster with respect to the overwhelming welfare of the population. There have been studies which have shown the number of city people who get sick because the price of agricultural products starts to move up because of cartels. There was a case in 1934 called Nebbia against New York, in which the great crime of which Mr. Nebbia was convicted was there was a minimum price for bread. It was 9 cents a loaf or something like that. He told two loaves for $18 or 18 cents, but he threw in a free loaf of bread with the milk. And so he was now a criminal. And the Supreme Court said, that's perfectly good to criminalize these sorts of people. Roosevelt created these cartels. It prolonged the New Deal. It accentuated the downward flight. And then what happens is you create sufficient kinds of social unrest that you actually do get concerns for the thing, well, we have to have a socialist system because capitalism has failed. It's not capitalism that's failed. It's cartels that have failed. And so what's going to happen here, if you give up the front ground and say, okay, now what we're doing is we're trying to head off this stuff, and you put in a number of dumb things, what's going to be the response of the misguided Elizabeth Warrens of this world? Says, well, you've conceded that markets don't work. Why are you stopping in the middle? And now you have to go to me. So what you're doing is you're giving them half a loaf and hope that you're going to keep the other half. It's not going to happen. And so I never, ever, ever want to take in a public day the position that these kinds of middle positions are in some sense preferable, either on their own merits or strategically. I regard them as all as passed down the road to greater socialization of the economy. I do not believe that competitive markets work everywhere in economy. That's why I talked about public utilities, roads, various kinds of various things that police forces have to do. But if you look at the New Deal, this was not designed to create infrastructure. This was a direct assault on competitive markets where competition actually worked and worked well. And so it's one thing for you to say, yes, we have to figure out how rate regulation works for airlines, maybe, but although it's not monopolistic anymore, but with public utilities, probably because it was. But you certainly don't have to figure out how rate regulation is going to work for agriculture, where if you let things go, it'll be straight competition. Yes, some firms will fail and they should go out of business, but it's a sign of a healthy market that bankrupt firms go out of business. Otherwise, it creates huge demands for cross subsidies by everybody else, and you start having massive dislocations elsewhere within the system. So if you only look at the plight of the loser and don't look at the gains to anybody else, it may well be that you want sympathy. If you want to give sympathy, you could do it privately through charity. You don't want to create large public institutions which essentially subsidize failed institutions and then make it more difficult for successful institutions to get started and to prosper. So once again, this is, I think, just a gigantic kind of error. There is no sense whatsoever to this. What you have to do is to explain why it is that the mix between government regulation and private competition that the classical liberal theory supports is incorrect, and they haven't come within a country mile of doing it.
All right. Thank you, Richard, and thank you to our listeners. Remember, you can read Richard's column, The Libertarian, by visiting Defining Ideas at hoover.org, and you can follow him on Twitter. That's at Richard A. Epstein. And if you enjoy the podcast, please rate it on iTunes. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.